Chapter 36, Some Frankish Missionaries. As we already know, after the great migration of nations, the Franks dwelled in the south of the Netherlands. They, too, were rude and cruel heathens. About the year 500, the heathen King Clovis reigned over the Frankish Empire. He was a tyrant. Was he a coward? No, he was no coward. On the battlefield, he could be found in the front of the battle with his mighty sword clenched in his fist. Then he was the terror of his enemies, because everyone that opposed him was cut down. Yea, he could fight. During his 30-year reign, Clovis had to wage many wars, for he had no quiet life. First, he fought against the remaining Romans who still lived in his realm, and he overcame them. Ah, in that way it went fine. His object was to become powerful and rich by fighting and obtain victories. And the gods assisted him. The gods always assisted the brave, the strong, and the heroes. And yet, when Clovis returned triumphantly as a victor from his bloody wars, when his sword, which in the war had been so often colored red by the blood of his defeated enemies, rested from the war, and he sat in the large hall of his palace in the midst of his family, then he heard other sounds. Then in the evening he sat with his wife, Clotilda, who spoke to him about other things. She told him about Jesus, who allowed himself to be crucified. Then Clovis listened with a contemptuous smile upon his face, with a mocking twinkle in his eyes. He could have no respect for a God who permitted himself to be crucified. According to him, that was no God. Clovis did not acknowledge that God of the cross. In those quiet evenings, Clovis heard his wife Clotilda speak about love for one's neighbor. Then she pointed out to him that he should have compassion with his enemies because Clotilda was a Christian. Oh, certainly. Then he listened patiently to her, but the mocking expression in his eyes remained. But yet she persevered and did not lose courage. Time after time she told him the beautiful, wonderful stories out of God's word. Time after time she pointed out to him the wrong and the wickedness of his rude heathen life. Then she warned her husband earnestly against sin. Then she pointed him to Christ, who died for his enemies, who shed his blood upon Golgotha's hill. And that contemptuous smile came again upon his face. No, he wanted to have nothing to do with Christianity. He was more pleased with the service of the gods. And yet, yea, he did not know himself how it happened, but at times a strange reverence arose in his heart. But then he resisted that. Ah, come, he should be wiser and not allow himself to be influenced by the stories of his wife. Compassion with his enemies? Love for one's neighbor? Clovis knew nothing of that. Once again, war broke out. The savage heathen Alemanni dwelled in the eastern boundary of his great, extensive kingdom. That people invaded his territory with a powerful army. But Clovis does not fear them. Ah, he shall repulse that people. He shall drive those strange intruders away. New victories await him. Swiftly he assembles his army, and when everything is ready, he marches with his thousands of brave soldiers to battle. Clotilda remains behind all alone again. Did she pray for her heathen husband? You may be sure of that. In the meantime, Clovis hastens to the boundary of his realm where the danger threatens. Behold, both armies clash with each other. The fighting which now breaks loose is terrible. Thousands upon thousands are killed. Clovis himself performs wonders of bravery. We may find him at the most dangerous places. He encourages his men with word and deed. But all that is of no avail. The Alemanni are too strong. In spite of their desperate resistance, the Frankish soldiers are gradually forced back. The Frankish army wavers. The fear increases in the heart of Clovis. To him it is clear that he shall lose this battle. He calls upon the gods, but they do not help him. There is no help. On the contrary, the Alemanni advance as a tidal wave which cannot be stopped. Oh, the terror which, as it were, closed the throat of King Clovis paralyzes him. If he loses this war, then everything is lost. Then his country shall be devastated by the cruel, unmerciful Alemanni. The villages and the cities shall go up in flames. Women and children shall be cruelly murdered or carried away as slaves. Clovis trembles when he thinks of that. Is there then nothing, nothing that can save him? In that great distress, he calls upon the God of the Christians, and he promises, if that God gives him the victory, then he shall also become a Christian. With renewed courage, he plunges himself into the fierce struggle, and the God of the Christians does help. The battle, which was virtually lost, changes into a splendid victory for him. The Alemanni are forced back, having been surprised by the sudden attack of the Franks, upon which they had no longer counted. They became confused and take to flight. The threatened danger has been turned. Behold, there he marches back with his victorious army. It is true, the Frankish army has suffered tremendous losses. Thousands do not return home to their wives and children. Their dead bodies cover the bloody battlefield. But they have not given their lives in vain. Victory has been won. Clovis has nevertheless not forgotten his promise. He keeps his word. In the city of Reims, with 3,000 of his brave warriors, he has himself baptized. Clovis has accepted Christianity because now he has seen and experienced that the God of the cross of the Christians is stronger than the gods which he has worshipped till now. Did Clovis in truth become a Christian? Alas, probably not. He retained his heathen heart. It is true, we are not to judge, but the fruits do not point to that, although we must not forget that the times then were rude and cruel. However that may be, yet this action of the king had great consequences for his land and people, for now that the king had himself baptized, soon thousands of his subjects followed the example of the king. Churches and monasteries were built everywhere in the Frankish Empire. The gospel was preached everywhere. Thus the land of the heathen Franks has gradually become a Christian land. The golden thread of God's rule also runs through this history. Also in this, the Almighty directed things in such a way that the kingdom of God was enlarged. And when, after a few centuries, the Church of God in the East would be ruined and swept away by the tidal wave of Mohammedanism, the Lord is busy now already to plant his church in the West. Also in this is confirmed that the gates of hell shall not prevail against his church. It is true, locally, that church may disappear in certain countries, but then it shall be established in other countries. Even though the Frankish kingdom had now become a Christian nation, with that, heathenism has not yet disappeared. Oh no, on the contrary. In the north and in the west of the Netherlands lived the savage Frisians, and in the east lived the Saxons. These heathen people had no thought of accepting Christianity. Naturally, brave missionaries set out from the Frankish Empire to the north to also preach the gospel there. Those missionaries did this with love in their hearts. They had compassion on all those people who still lived in the dark night of heathenism. They also wanted to acquaint those people with the way of salvation. Those Frisians and Saxons must also learn to bend their knees before the God of heaven and earth. This was their great object. For that they faced the many dangers which threatened them from all sides. Those Frankish missionaries meant well, but the Frankish kings endeavored to gradually extend their territory and power. They tried their utmost to subdue the Frisian and Saxon people. All those people must be united into one empire, and then they would be king of that powerful realm. How powerful would they then become? At the thought of that, their heart swelled with pride. Those Frankish kings now saw in Christianity a splendid means to reach that desired object. By that, they would be able to extend their power over those people. For that reason, the Frankish kings gave letters along with the missionaries that set out to the north. Those letters supposedly must serve to protect the missionaries, for in those letters was written that they must not harm those Frankish missionaries because they were under royal protection. But those kings had a hidden motive with that, and this was thoroughly understood by those Frisians and Saxons. But the Frisian and Saxon people did not want to be submissive to the Franks. They were free people, and they wanted to remain free. They would with blood defend their liberty. Those Frisians and Saxons hated the Frankish people. The Franks were their mortal enemies. And since the Frankish missionaries came to them with letters from the Frankish kings, they also hated the missionaries. They said to each other, "Those missionaries are spies from the Frankish king. Away with them. Kill them. Do not listen to them." And that Christianity which they want to force upon us, they try to deceive us with that. If we accept Christianity, then that means that we must be subject also to the Franks, and that we shall never do. We are free. And we want to remain free, away with Christianity. The Frisians and Saxons confused these two things with each other, because those Frankish missionaries were no spies. They came north to deliver them from the service of the gods. They came to acquaint them with the way of salvation. But those heathen people did not believe that. For that reason, it would have been much better if the Frankish missionaries simply did not have any letters from the Frankish kings with them, for now those missionaries were immediately suspected by them. A double hatred arose against the Frankish missionaries. In the first place, they experienced the usual enmity of the heathen priests against Christianity. That enmity is experienced by all missionaries that enter into the heathen world. That is the usual strife between Christ and the prince of darkness, between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. And that enmity is already bad enough in itself. Those missionaries must endeavor with endless patience to overcome and remove that enmity and suspicion. But in the second place, in addition to the usual enmity against the missionaries from the Frankish Empire, came the political hatred, which means that they were looked upon as spies from the Frankish kings. The Frankish missionaries had to struggle against that twofold enmity and suspicion. For that reason, those Frankish missionaries did not have much blessing upon their labor. It is true, God's word shall never return void. They did have some blessing, but for themselves it was terribly difficult, doubly difficult. We understand that now, do we not? You are a spy, an ugly Frankish spy. What business do you have here in our country? By and by you want to betray us to the Frankish king. Just go back again. We will have nothing to do with you. We do not trust you. See them thronging around him. Rude, angry cries ring out wildly. Fists are clenched. Hatred, profound hatred, blazed in their eyes. And then, oh, just look, in the midst of that furious, threatening, yelling multitude, stands an unarmed man. They do not listen to his words. They yell above it. They do not want to listen. What he says is all fraud anyway. Being defenseless, he has been delivered up to the rage of this people. Those that stand closest to him seize him roughly and firmly. They drag him along and cast him into the water of the river which flows nearby. A loud splash. The waves close themselves over the head of that pitiful one. A scornful laugh rises up from that turbulent crowd. Then they go away without troubling themselves about that deplorable one, who miserably drowns in those gray waters. Drown? No, surely not. With vigorous, powerful strokes, he swims to the other side and disappears in the dark forests which borders the river. Who is that man? Why are they so angry with him? Why do they not want to listen to his words? Why do they cast him without pity into the water, so that he shall find death there? Listen. Naturally, we have understood long already that the man who was just now flung into the water was a missionary. Isn't that right? Right. So it is. His name is Amandus. Already at an early age, he had an irresistible urge within him to go out and preach the gospel to the heathens. He became monk against the wish of his father and spent several years in a monastery. While there, he studied hard to qualify himself for the task which awaited him. After that, he went to the southern Low Countries, to Flanders in Belgium, where at that time heathen Frisians lived. He would soon convert those half-savage people to Christianity. Yea, but suppose they do not want to. Suppose they are exceedingly hostile over against Christianity. What? Not want to? They must become Christians. He shall compel them to accept Christianity. They must relinquish their heathen idolatry. He shall baptize them. If it is not willing, then unwilling. And do not let them try to harm him, because he has received a letter from the Frankish king telling them that he is under the special protection of the king of the Franks. If he will show them that, then they will not dare to harm him. Full of courage, he starts to work. The heathen temples, which he comes across everywhere, he simply has them pulled down by his assistants. They are leveled with the ground. Everywhere churches are built in the place of them. Now then, that is already a good start. Now the Frisians can go to church instead of to those heathen temples. Ah, Amandus's intentions were good, but he went about it in the wrong way. The gospel must not be brought with force. Do we not read in God's word, not by might, nor by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord of hosts? Whoever wants to spread the gospel must in the first place be filled with love toward his fellow man, and with patience and wisdom he must endeavor to gain the people for Christianity. The result is that Amandus is sadly disappointed in his great expectations. It is altogether different from what he had thought, because with pent-up rage, the Frisians behold the destruction of their sanctuaries. Wild hatred blazes up within them, and they hurl that foreign intruder into the Scheldt River. They laugh at that letter from the Frankish king. However, Amandus does not as yet lose courage. He continued in the same manner to bring Christianity to them. Again, it ends in failure. Those Frisians maltreat him and cast him into the river for the second time. Amandus escapes death through drowning the second time by swimming to the other side. But when he sees that they will not listen to him, when he notices that their hatred and rage increase, then he becomes discouraged, and being disappointed, he leaves Flanders. He complains, nothing can be done with those people. Yet later on he went back again to Flanders and has preached by renewal among those people. Did he go about it in a different way this time? I can give you no answer upon this because I do not know. He did see some fruit upon that labor. A small number of Frisians went over to Christianity and had themselves baptized. He even founded some monasteries along the Scheldt River. In the year 679, he died in Flanders. His work was carried on by others. The Frankish kings often waged war. At times, they were wars of defense. That means they were attacked by surrounding hostile tribes, so that they were compelled to defend their country. But very often, they were wars of conquest. Then they tried to extend their domain at the expense of other countries. How much misery and sorrow was then poured out upon those people? Who shall be able to count the number of soldiers, either dead or wounded, that remained behind upon the battlefield? God only knows that number. And not only that, just think of the many prisoners that were carried along to perform hard slave labor in strange lands. Men were snatched away from their families. Children never saw their parents again. Ah, they were also human beings, just as we are. They also loved their wives and children and their parents. What must have been the thoughts in the hearts of those many men and youths? One who is the searcher of hearts is able to give an answer upon that. Behold, there those conquered Frisians are firmly bound, without mercy dragged away roughly and violently by the victorious Frankish soldiers. Don't you see the sorrowful expression upon the faces of those poor prisoners of war? Don't you see how they look back time and again to cast a last look at their beloved native land, which perhaps they may never see again? With a deep sigh, they walk onward. The Frankish soldiers who lead them away do not see that, or if they do see it, then they are not concerned about it. What do they care about the grief of their fellow men? Ah, by and by they shall sell their victims for much money at the slave market. The more they receive for it, the better they like it. In my mind, I see those prisoners of war standing on the slave market in the Frankish Empire. It is very busy there. People are talking and laughing. But the prisoners do not laugh. Sadly, they stare straight ahead. To them, life is finished. Only the miserable existence of slavery awaits them. They shall be treated as beasts, yea, even less than beasts. Behold, there walks a young man among all those buyers and sellers. This man does not laugh. No, his heart is filled with pity. He buys one of those slaves that are exhibited there. He buys another, and still another. He buys just as long till his money bag is empty. And then? See him leaving the market with his new possessions, and he goes through the various streets to his home. The slaves purchased by him follow their master. What shall the future bring them? Shall they obtain a cruel, hard-hearted master? They do not know. It is better than was expected. They are properly fed and clothed. He is friendly toward them. He shall never maltreat or strike one of them. On the contrary, they do not have to work hard, nor overwork themselves either. Their work consists mainly in listening. Listening? Yes. Because their master tells those slaves that their gods are no gods. He points them to the living God. He points them to the Savior who died on the cross. He tells them that there is also a possibility for them to be saved. In a word, he brings the gospel to those wretched ones. Ah, in the beginning, those heathen Frisians shall not have understood much of that. But they did listen because they were treated so kindly. And then? Then one day that friendly master gives them their liberty. They may return to their own country. In my mind I see them go with faces beaming with happiness. They may return to their wife and children or to their father and mother. They may return to their beloved native country. They had not counted on that. Who is that wonderful man? Why does he do all that? His name is Eligius. He was born in 580 in the Frankish Empire. In his youth he was a heathen. He was brought up in the service of the gods. However, one day he hears Columban speak, the missionary from Ireland. We told you about that in the previous chapter, isn't that so? That preaching becomes a blessing to him because the Lord sanctified it to his heart and converted him. Since that moment, Eligius was a Christian in truth who had learned to see the emptiness of the idol worship. Eligius was a goldsmith by trade, and he understood his trade so well that soon he was known everywhere. He never had to complain because of lack of work, for they came to him from far and near. Even the Frankish king heard them speak about Eligius. He could make good use of such a capable goldsmith. He sent for him, and Eligius entered into the service of the king. From now on, Eligius lived in a beautiful house and earned very much money. Now he made coins, pieces of money for the Frankish king. He became master of the mint. And what did Eligius do with all the money that he earned? Did he save all this carefully, hoping to become wealthy one day? Ah, no, he was no miser. On the contrary, he assisted the poor people in his surroundings as much as he could. He gave money to the sick and the infirm, so that they could be provided for in their wants. They spoke about him with respect and love. When upon a certain day he came to the slave market and saw all that misery, he had so much compassion for those poor prisoners of war that he ransomed various slaves. Henceforth he visited those slave markets regularly. He ransomed hundreds of slaves, at times as many as 50 in one day. His chief purpose was to acquaint them with Christianity, and then he let them go back to their country and to their people, hoping that they would become preachers of Christianity in their own country. Did he achieve his object therewith? Ah, not with many. They soon forgot what they had heard from Eligius and became heathens again. But those that became Christians in truth could not keep silence about Christ. One day, the day of eternity, shall reveal the fruits which the labor of Eligius has borne. Eligius himself was a quiet, friendly man. He had an encouraging word for everyone that was in trouble. He was an altogether different person than Amandus, about whom I just told you. When Eligius saw those poor heathen slaves, then many times the desire welled up in his heart to go himself one day and preach in the land of the Frisians. Then he felt an urge within him to go and live and labor among that Frisian people and to bring the glad tidings to them. One day he spoke about it with the Frankish king. The king put on a serious face because he did not want to part with his able master of the mint. But finally Eligius obtained his wish. He was appointed as bishop of Noyon, and from that moment Eligius entered into the heathen world. It is true, he was not received kindly everywhere, because the Frisians saw in him another spy of the Frankish king. They have mocked, beaten, and maltreated him. However, the brave missionary never reviled back. He patiently endured insult and revilement. For many years he has labored in Flanders and in Zeeland among the savage Frisians, and his work has not been in vain. Here and there churches were founded by him. Idol temples and images were destroyed. Eligius labored on unweariedly. It is a pity that he also experienced that dual enmity, and often his good intentions were not understood. In the year 658, at the age of 78 years, he died in peace. The memory of the just is blessed. A great multitude of heathen Frisians from far and near has flocked together at Maidenblik, a place in North Holland. The leading Frisians from miles around are there present. We even see Radbod, the king of the Frisians, also standing among those that are present. Why have all those people come to Maidenblik? A feast is being celebrated. It is a real heathen sacrificial feast. However, this time no handsome horse shall be offered, Neither shall a splendid fat steer be offered, such as usually takes place at such occasions. For this special occasion, the offering shall consist of a human being, a youth. Who is that pitiful one who must give his life? Yea, that is not known as yet. But look, the priests in their long white robes are making themselves ready to cast the lot. The gods themselves shall point out their choice. With serious faces, conscious of their dignity, the priests walk slowly to the front. The important moment is at hand. All eyes are turned toward the front, where the lot shall be decided. It becomes anxiously quiet. In breathless suspense, they all wait for the result. They stretch their necks. The hearts of the many young Frisians beat uneasy as they watch the actions of the priests with increased suspense. One of them must die. They know that. Naturally, there is a possibility that the lot shall fall upon them, but they suppress the gnawing fear, and seemingly undisturbed, they watch the preparations with a forced indifference. The decisive moment is there, as one very important, an aged heathen priest casts the small sticks. With serious faces, they bend themselves over those small sticks to study their position. Then they arise. The suspense becomes unbearable. Thousands of eyes are fixed upon them. The eyes of the priests wander a moment over the multitude and finally rest upon a vigorous, healthy boy who has also awaited the outcome with an anxiously beating heart. Then a priest's arm is slowly raised aloft, and he is pointed out. He shall serve as the sacrifice. As cold as ice, the voice of the priest sounds, "The gods have chosen him." All eyes follow the direction of the outstretched arm. There stands the youth that is condemned to die. A ghastly paleness covers the face of the wretched one when he hears the dreadful sentence. His eyes twitch nervously. He trembles, and for a moment he wavers, but nothing can be done about it. It is the will of the gods. Poor, poor people, they know no better. The youth, who is chosen by this horrible lot, makes no objection and does not struggle against it. It is the will of the gods. Therefore, submissively, he bows the head. He submits himself. Poor boy. Ah, neither does he know better. Radbod the king watches all this with interest. His eyes sparkle. A smile is upon his lips, while his muscular hand rests upon his huge broadsword. He nods approvingly. Yea, that is fine. He casts an approving glance at the youth, who has been chosen by the lot. Again, an approving nod, which is scarcely noticeable. The gods will be satisfied. This sacrifice will incline the gods favorably, and henceforth they shall help him in his desperate struggle against the Franks. Oh, those Franks! He hates them. He hates them with a wild, untamed hatred. They want to subject him and his people. They want to make slaves of that sturdy, free, Frisian people. Oh, and the strong teeth of Radbod gnash, and at the thought thereof, his eyes blaze. Oh, those hypocritical Franks! First they send missionaries to draw the Frisians away from the ancient service of the gods. They preach a god of the cross. Bah! A contemptuous, despicable laugh curls the closely pressed lips of the Frisian king. But then his expression becomes somber again. Yea, and when they have become Christians, then at the same time they have lost their liberty. But no, not that. Never. His fists clench convulsively. For that reason Radbod is such a fierce enemy of Christianity. For that reason he had the little Christian church in Utrecht demolished. For that reason he caused the monasteries to be burned to the ground. And without pity has those monks that lived in them cut down. For that reason he has no respect for the gray hairs of the prior, the father superior of the monastery. For that reason he did not spare the life of the young monks. Their cry for help sounded like music in his ears. He does not want to become a Christian, not now and never. He does not want to become a servant of the Frankish kings. He wants to be free. He shall not tolerate that his people become enslaved by those miserable Franks. They are free Frisians, and they shall remain free Frisians. Unconsciously he stamps upon the ground. Oh, in spite of their courageous, desperate resistance, his brave, undaunted soldiers have been defeated twice already by the Frankish king. He gnashes his teeth again, and when he thinks of that, then in wild rage he clenches his fists. See him standing there by that sacrificial feast at Maidenblick. But now it shall change. Now that handsome youth shall be offered to the gods. This offering shall dispose the gods favorably toward them. Now the gods shall help him. Now his brave Frisians shall be repulsed no more. Poor Radbod, he knows no better. He beholds with satisfaction how the youth is led to a large oak on which the halter is already hanging, while swaying silently back and forth in the wind. It becomes breathlessly quiet for the second time, because when it had been decided who was destined for the offering, an approving murmur had broken the prevailing silence. Many have breathed more easily. Happily, they are free. Behold, there stands the youth beneath the oak. A hand already seizes the end of the rope that is hanging down. Suddenly, a powerful voice breaks the oppressive silence. Stop, king! Release that boy! Your gods are no gods. This youth shall enter death needlessly. This sacrifice has no value. Your gods cannot help you, because they do not exist. A shock runs through the multitude, and all eyes seek the speaker. However, they do not have to seek long, because he already steps undauntedly to the front. He addressed the king so clearly and distinctly that all have understood his words. A threatening murmur resounds. Hateful looks are cast upon him, but he does not tremble. fearlessly he looks at the mighty king. Who of us would have dared to do that? How great a courage was necessary for this, because he gambled with his life. Who is he? He is a missionary from the Frankish kingdom. His name is Wilfred. King Radbod beholds the missionary with a withering look. Again, one of those miserable Frankish missionaries. Another one of those spies from the Frankish king. Oh, Radbod feels the wild hate blaze up within him. One word from him, and his faithful subjects shall tear him to pieces. How does that Christian dog dare to enter into this sacred place? It becomes alarmingly quiet. What shall be the result of this? However, Radbod controls himself. He shrugs his shoulders and answers short and sarcastically, "The gods have appointed him as the offering, and that shall take place." He speaks those words in a commanding tone, without tolerating contradiction. He continues scornfully, "Well then, if your God, that God of the cross of the Christians, is as powerful as you say he is, then let him save this youth from death." Without further considering the missionary worthy of a glance, he turns to the priests and gives them a sign. They take hold of the youth and put the noose around the neck of the wretched boy. Wilfred folds his hands and prays, "O God, thou God of heaven and earth, thou almighty God, do show that thou art stronger. Help, Lord." Shall it avail? Priests draw the rope tight. Yet a few moments, and the youth shall swing between heaven and earth. The feet of the offering no longer touch the ground. But then suddenly the rope breaks, on which the youth hangs, and he falls down. Being appalled, they all see what has happened. They are almost afraid to breathe. Inquiringly, they direct their glance at the king. Radbod also stands there as if he is rooted to the ground. He is confused for a moment, but only briefly. Soon he recovers himself, and then he cries out loudly, "The youth is free. The gods do not desire this offering." Wilfred answers immediately, "No, king, not the gods, but the God of the Christians has saved this boy from death." The impression is powerful. For a moment, everything remains calm, but then a commotion starts among the multitude. The Frisians look at each other significantly. A confused noise of voices is heard. Nothing comes of the offering now. All at once the feast is finished. The multitude dissolves. The people go home, busily discussing with each other that which has happened. Respect has grown in many hearts for that courageous missionary. At any rate, he is no coward, and the Frisians know how to appreciate courage. Does not come up in their mind to harm him. Behold, there stands Wilfred. The glory of victory lies upon his face, and his eyes shine. His God has not put him to shame. You may be sure that a prayer of thanksgiving ascended from his soul. The youth, which was saved from death, timidly draws near to the Frankish missionary. All go home, but he remains with Wilfred. Having been saved from a certain death, He knows not how to show his gratitude. However, Wilfrid does not ask for a reward. He did instruct that youth in the Christian doctrine. That instruction has borne fruit. He had himself baptized, and with that he manifested to his countrymen that he had become a Christian. Later, he brought the gospel to his own people. How wonderful are God's ways! However much Satan may rage, God shall fulfill his counsel. God has directed everything here to the extension of his church. Radbod the king also went away. However, he is not happy and cheerful. Doubt slips into his heart. He had surely counted on it, that from now on the gods would help him. But he no longer possesses that certainty. He is at a loss. He does not know. Is then the God of the Christians really stronger and mightier than the gods? His firm trust in the gods has been shaken. Many questions rise in his heart, questions to which he can give no answer. However, he has respect for that Frankish missionary. He was no coward, and for that reason he had let him go unharmed. In the meantime, Wilfrid preaches among the Frisians, and that preaching is blessed by the Lord. Many have themselves baptized. It is even told that the son of Radbod also went over to Christianity. Some writers make mention of that. Then gradually the thought arises with Wilfrid, what a blessing it would be if I was successful in persuading Radbod over to Christianity. He shall try to the utmost of his power. He calls on the king in his palace. That is a bold venture. He converses long and seriously with him, and, to be sure, he is successful. The king does not have him arrested, but listens attentively to him. Some time later, a large baptismal font stands ready. The Frisian king, the mighty one, the enemy and the dread of the Christians, is going to have himself baptized. What a victory for Wilfrid! No one has yet succeeded in that. Has Wilfrid become proud of that which he was unable to do? I do not know. Behold him standing there at the baptismal font. He expects Radbod. He does not have to wait long, because there the king draws near already. Wilfrid makes himself ready to perform the solemn act which shall crown his labors. A solemn stillness prevails. This action of the king shall undoubtedly have great results, for if the king sets an example, then the people shall follow. That was also with Clovis, the king of the Franks, was it not? Some writers tell us that Radbod had already put his one foot into the baptismal waters. Suddenly he hesitates. He looks straight into the eyes of the missionary and asks, "Tell me, where are my ancestors? Are they also in heaven?" Wilfrid frightens terribly when that is asked of him. He is silent for a moment, but he must answer the king. But yet he does not want to deceive him. He says, "They are lost." He can and may not speak otherwise. Radbod says, "Well, then I would rather be with my ancestors in Valhalla than with the Christians in heaven." He withdraws his foot out of the baptismal font, turns himself around, and walks calmly back to his house. Being dumbfounded, Wilfrid stares after him. failed. It hammers in his head, failed. What a humiliation for him, so near to the desired object, and yet all in vain. He had not counted on that anymore. Being profoundly disappointed, Wilfrid leaves the country of the Frisians. The desire to continue with his labor has left him all at once. He locks himself in his monastery, and several years later, in the year 720, he dies there. At that time, Radbod, the king of the Frisians, was no longer alive. He had already died some months before. It is said that during the last years of his life, Radbod no longer persecuted the Christians. Whether that is true, I cannot say with certainty. From this history, the sovereignty of God is clearly manifested. Wilfrid did not understand that, and for that reason he became thoroughly despondent. Wilfrid thought that all was lost, but he was mistaken. God's ways are different from our ways. Seemingly, it goes wrong at times. The reason for that is because we cannot always follow and account for God's ways. But God himself vouches for his own work, and that work of God goes right on, and although we can no longer see it, God never loses his great object out of sight. If Wilfrid had directed his eyes more to that, then he surely would not have become so discouraged, but then unweariedly he would have continued his labor. Then he would have done what he could, and leave the issue with God. Not at Wilfrid's time, but at God's time, the Frisian people shall bend the knee before the living God.